I am happy to announce our 2024 Banking with Life client-only event. It's going to happen Friday, October 25th, beginning with a pre-event social mixer. The day of the event is Saturday the 26th, followed by an after party. It's going to happen downtown Fort Worth. I will be speaking there. Others will be speaking as well. You'll have the opportunity to meet me, and I'm looking forward to meeting you. You'll have the opportunity to meet the whole Banking with Life team and a room full of people that practice the infinite banking concept from all over the country. Last year, we had about 130 people from 30 different states. The year before that was really good, too. This year is going to be even better. We're going to have educational presentations and talks, and that should be important to you if you're practicing the infinite banking concept. I can't wait to see you. So in this episode, my friend Barry Dyke joins us once again. He's a perennial guest. I love him. He's a friend. He's a researcher among researchers. And we primarily talked about his fourth book that was just released, The Retirement Ruse, how stock buybacks, cryptocurrencies, unicorns, and SPACs help destroy America's savings and retirement plans. I'm just 16 pages into this book, and I've got to go back over those 16 pages and highlight the fire out of it. I can't wait to finish the book personally. I think that you would enjoy reading it. And we had a great conversation. So thank you for listening.
You know, that's why I get into things like the SPACs. There was a guy by the name of Michael Klein, K-L-E-I-N-E. Oh, he had a, he was kind of like one of the SPAC kings. And he was a Citigroup banker. And he went on his own. He created M. Klein & Associates. And he brought all his companies public using SPACs. And matter of fact, Credit Suisse, now this is stupid. They spent $175 million buying his investment banker practice, and he was going to bring Credit Suisse, First Boston, back into the limelight in American investment banking. That was his designation. Okay. Now, he did a lot of shitty deals, but I get into the deals like a Multiplan, which was unfortunately, it was almost like a corporate gangbang of private equity. And then he brings it public. And I think it, looked at it yesterday, but I think Multiplan went public in a SPAC at around $10 a share. I think it's 32 cents, 35 cents now. So they're hanging on by a thread now. And this is through a SPAC. So if you couldn't make this stuff up, that's why I had to do this.
You know, that reminds me of Lehman Brothers, forced out. That was a push out, in my opinion. You know, they're bailing everybody else out, but not Lehman Brothers. You know, it's like the pack turns on itself kind of a situation. But I remember that date. I can go pull the date up because I bought a life insurance policy on the exact date, right? And I didn't realize this until two or three years later, and I'm, you know, spending some time with a young agent, just showing him how life insurance works and why, you know, how to structure or whatever. And he pointed it out to me. He said, James, because the issue date, right, is always on the policy. He goes, you know, he just pointed that date out. And he said, do you understand the significance of that date? And I said, no, you know, it's like, no, I don't. And it was the date that that Lehman Brothers went broke. And so it gave us an opportunity. And so that was looking back, right, at the time. And so you look at Lehman Brothers, what happened at the date? Of course, that's a terrible date for them, right? And then compared to a life insurance policy issued on that date, which would you rather have? You know, in my mind, I know what I'd rather have. I'm just saying I remember the date. I can go pull the date that Lehman Brothers went out. And then if I go back to Citi, you mentioned Citigroup and your terminology for them. Citigroup, right? They own Citibank, right? And if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, they purchased Prime America, who purchased A.O. Williams. So the old buy term and invest the difference, and I'm not slamming on that. Any of the entities or individuals, it's the concept that I learned in my experience over 33 years, because I started my career 33 years ago buying term and investing the difference. I bought that hook, line, and sinker. So, you know, you fast forward 33 years, but early on, I'm like, no, that's not the solution. My point here is Citibank, Citigroup, owns Citibank, owns Prime America, Prime America by A.O. Williams. So they're telling all of their consumers to buy term and invest the difference. But wait, how much whole life, guaranteed, permanent life engine? They don't buy IULs and they don't buy VULs. I don't care what anybody says on social media. I wonder why. Because of the guarantees. So they buy whole life insurance. And so how many billions of dollars do they own, Citigroup, and whole life insurance? While they're telling their clients and their customers to buy term and invest the difference, it's almost, do what I say, not what I do. Across the board in this financial paradigm that we live in today. So thank you for letting
me. Yeah, no, that's very true. You know, James, is like, obviously, I have a good friend of mine, Steve Church. He's an actuary, and he's a blessing in my life. And, you know, because I've done a lot of research, you know, of these corporations, how they use annuities and things like that. And I was looking at, you know, the how they, Clorox, the bleach company, you know, they bought these, you know, pretty good size annuities, like 100. They bought two of them, and sometimes they don't disclose it, but I know they, for a fact, they bought two to finance a pension plan. But I'm looking through all the their 10K, which they have to file, which is a matter of public record, and I'm seeing all the guaranteed retirement plans for all these top executives of Clorox. So, yeah. So they're throwing all their rank and file folks under the bus. And this is, I looked at the 10K, I was like, oh my goodness. You know, this is it. So the executives, they all have severance plans and guaranteed annuities and deferred comp and all this really good stuff. And but the regular folks, you know, they terminated the pension plan, and now they're putting them into 401ks. So you see it, you know, and that's, you know, I love this country. I really, really do. But what the thing is that what you're seeing is that a lot of the stuff is really going to the 1%, if you will. And but the irony of the whole thing is that they really don't, the really wealthy don't want to have a lot of risk. And also, too, when you get to a certain point, a certain degree of wealth, you have so much money, it really doesn't matter. You can ride out these markets, but most people can't. The Federal Reserve Bank of New York, 10% of the population owns 90% of the stocks. So this is what's happening. So we have this hypocrisy, but I want to really get people to actually real facts to show people how their money's being gambled. It's just the pandemic. It was just like an unprecedented gambling in stocks, an orgy, if you will.
Really? Go into that. Can you share on that? Do you get in that in your book or?
Yeah, I do. I get into it, and yeah. So I on the whole thing is it's kind of sad. I get into the whole autonomous vehicle. Everyone wants to have autonomous cars, like we're in the Jetsons or something like that, you know. But the money blown on this has just been. I found at least over $100 billion was born, was invested into autonomous vehicles, and a lot of them. A lot of these cars can't even turn left, and they can't see children or small animals and things like that. So it's just. I mean, someday we will see them. I don't know if it'll be in our lifetime, but the money just blown. I mean, Apple, which amazed me. Apple's was a very secretive company on this stuff. And General Motors. I mean, hello, folks. How many times do we have to bail them out? So General Motors, and I got this actually from the public records, James. They had that autonomous vehicle Cruise, which Mary Barra says is going to be the future of GM by 2030. Well, I don't think so. She said it was going to be nearly $30 billion in revenue in 2030. And she said this. I got this. And they put $9.7 billion into Cruise, and it's been for the most part shut down. Then the Apple, They had it's very, even though it was a public company, they operated in a very, very secretive autonomous vehicle. They thought they were going to outdo Elon Musk. And Apple spent $10 billion. I call it the Apple car crash. and they when they shut it down, and actually it was this year, James, they shut it down. I had no idea that Apple had spent $10 billion on autonomous vehicle. I had no idea. And but then it leaked out when they shut it down. But yeah, they shut it down actually in February of this year. So what are we? So this is February. So how many months ago? 7-8 months ago?
6. This is 8.
Yeah. So did you know that Apple spent $10 billion? They employed 2,000 people.
No, they were too secretive. I didn't know.
You know, I didn't know. So I mean, so all this stuff, and then you have all these companies like, you know, they had Airwinds, which was a flying motorcycle company, and then went to bankruptcy. And it's just stupid. I mean, it's just going on.
You get into
on
unicorns as well, because that's a terminology. I mean, I've used the terminology unicorns many times in the, you know, in the infinite banking footprint, and you know, fairies and, you know, leprechauns and unicorns. But there's a very specific term for these startups that come out of nowhere that are worth $1 billion or have $1 billion in startups.
Yeah, there was a woman, venture capitalist, her name was Eileen Lee. And she was out of a venture capital firm out of the West Coast called Cowboy Ventures. And she kind of coined the phrase of a mythical investment, you know, anything with $1 billion valuation or more. And they've multiplied like rabbits, James. And that's why I had to put this together. I said, this is a glimpse in history. And unless I record this, everyone's going to forget it.
Yeah.
So but it was absolutely insane. And now so we had autonomous cars and all this other crap and fake meats, which is beyond me, beyond me trading at maybe $5-6. But I show how all the insider executives are selling out at $120 a share. And now it's like $6. But the we go from one crazy adventure to the next. Another great example was, and then I get into the WeWork. Do you remember that one, James?
I do. Yep.
So you know, this is, you know, they put, you know, SoftBank. I mean, in SoftBank. I mean,
where were they based?
New York City, and they were actually the largest. They were actually the largest landlord in New York and London, and they had 770 commercial properties, and they had roughly $23-24 billion of venture capital poured into it. I mean, I'm talking, you know, from Wellington Management and J.P. Morgan and SoftBank.
Did they have property in, in France, in Paris?
Yeah, they had it all over the place.
And the reason I ask is because my family and I, on the last one of the travels that we've done previously, I think it was this year, we went to Paris. And part of the tour, you know, the tour guide who lives in Paris, he's pointing out this massive building, and I'm quite sure it was WeWorks.
So, anyways, you know, it was the whole thing that these guys forget all the stuff. The first business order of any business, you got to make a profit. But this is all so it was just, they poured all this money into it. And I get into the story just because, again, you couldn't, unless someone documented, unless I was a scribe for this, people wouldn't, they would forget it. But they put $23 billion of other people's money into it, you know. And also the mutual fund money from Fidelity and John Hancock and T. Rowe Price. Again, it's always, you know, looking for dumb retail money. And they put it into WeWork. And in 2019, James, the son, Masao Tsuji, son, the Japanese guy. So this is my next Alibaba, because he did have a very successful business called Alibaba, which he made a lot of billions on. And Morgan Stanley, they said this could be worth as much as $110 billion. Okay. It's like, hello. And then they, 2019, they tried to start bring the company public, of course, because the whole thing is, you know, finding the greater pool and cashing out. And and they started looking at the balance sheet, and the banker said, we can't present this on a traditional IPO because, you know, they have, like, you know, $2.5 billion in revenue and $3 billion in expenses. They're not making any money. So I couldn't, but anyway, so they valued it at $47 billion, and they went bankrupt about a year ago, and they also used reverse stock splits. And but Adam, but the founder, Adam Newman, the founder, he walked away with about $1.5 billion. And I think, yeah, SoftBank alone lost 12, 13 billion alone of other people's money. Wow. So this is what's going on with people's money. And so I documented it, but I also, you know, so everything's based upon filings. And then I also use a service called Crunchbase, which is a subscription service I pay for, you know, to verify everything.
You know, it seems to me like you have these life insurance companies, these conservative companies. You know, we've talked in the past about the pension risk transfer. These big companies, they're transferring the risk of the pension that they have, you know, paying their employees these pensions. They're offsetting that risk to life insurance companies.
Right? Yeah.
And then you have these, not all of them, but it seems to me, especially, I don't want to name any companies or anything like that, but it seems to me these companies, and it doesn't even have to be in the life insurance world, but these companies are trying to get unreasonable rates of return. And then they suffer from FOMO apparently as well, and they also suffer from, you know, the market always goes one way, you know, it's just on Monstrosa, never comes down, never corrects. Or and what makes these we're talking about billions of dollars. Why would these companies
actually trillions at this point?
Absolutely. Just that one company, you know, $23 billion and $20 billion here and $20 billion there. You're going to add up.
You're talking some money. All of a sudden,
yeah. Oh my gosh. I don't understand why. I mean, is it just greed to the nth degree? Are they just trying to hit some kind of number so they can walk away with more than $1.5 billion? You know, the guy was very disappointed when, after the bankruptcy, that's all he walked away with, right? $1.5 billion on WeWorks. I don't get it. I mean, I just don't understand it, Barry. Why they take these unreasonable risks? They're almost ungodly risk. And I get it, it's with other people's money, but you have to have a conscience. I mean, don't you have to get up in the morning and shave and sleep well at night and all those things? I mean, and two, you could apply it to the real estate at the you and me level. You know, everybody's trying to get a 20% rate of return, and this is a FOMO, and, you know, you win a couple, and maybe you hit those numbers a couple of times, maybe you have a good deal, you know, like Alibaba, so you just trying to pull the slot machine handle one more time to, you know, replicate it. So, if I round out my question, is what drives these people to risk so much of other people's money? I mean, have you?
What? Yeah, it's simple. It's greed.
It's just greed.
It's greed. I call it, it's rapacious greed. And, you know, and none of us, I'm no angel. I'm certainly not. And, but
you may not be an angel. I'll agree. I'm no angel either. But sir, you're not greedy at all. And I don't understand why you would risk so much of so many people's money and just, like, not think twice about it. I mean, I would. Does the suicide rate go up on these kind of people? I'm just asking.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think I'm a Christian. I know you are as well. I mean, I think really this is kind of a garage and an eternity. But their God is money. And, you know, I like money. Believe me. I mean, it's just as much as anyone, but it's not my God. And I I sleep at night. I know you do as well. And but I, you know, but how much is enough? I mean, it's just, I mean, it's just, look at Steven Schwarzman, who's the, you talk about Lehman Brothers. Now, Schwarzman, who was, he was a Lehman Brothers banker, and he started Blackstone, which is now the largest private equity firm in the world. I mean, he has, Steven Schwarzman has, I don't know, he just bought a property in London for like $100 million. He has another mansion down in Newport, which we're in New England here. So he bought another mansion down in Newport, like $27 billion. I think they've been restoring it for like 5-6 years, whatever. He has another home in Nantucket, right across the way. Now, because where we live in New England here, you know, this is where all the billionaires come at this time of year. This is a beautiful place, area to be. And then Schwarzman, he's got a home in St. Tropez. He's got another home on Jamaica. He's got a, and then he has John D. Rockefeller's apartment in New York, which I think has, I think it's the largest, it's like the largest apartment in New York. It's worth like $120 million. So how much do people really need? I mean, but this is, my point is that I'm all for people making money, you know, believe me, but the tax code is really rigged in their favor. And that's why people are doing it with, you know, the carried interest. And then they're saying, and they're saying, well, hey, there's all this money on these insurance companies, let's go after them. And that's what they're done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, but, you know, bankruptcy, you know, it's just, you know, that's why I'm beginning to the Pirates 3, James, but I'm getting ahead of myself. But that's why, but the bankruptcy was just incomprehensible. And the defaults, you know, are just incomprehensible.
Do you have the subtitle for Pirates of Manhattan 3?
The Pirates of Manhattan 3 is going to be the Pirates of Manhattan 3, how private equity robber barons became the new, you know, how private equity titans became the new robber barons.
How private equity
titans
became
the new robber barons.
Yeah. And I don't want to, I mean, like I said, I just started on this fabulous book. And, you know, like I said earlier, and I'm just going to say again, I don't normally go in and highlight the original, you know, copy that was signed by the author. Thank you very much. But you did highlight it. So it gave me free, you know, pass to highlight. And I just started reading it this morning. I'm not kidding you. And I've only gotten 18, I'm not even through the forward and the acknowledgement, right? And I'm going to go the introduction, the forward and the introduction. I'm going to go back and highlight. There are so many things. I was telling Julie when I came in, I was telling her this, you know, just started, just got it. And where's a highlighter? Because I'm going to go back and start over and highlight. There's so much stuff here to highlight in the first 16 pages. And we hadn't even gotten into the house, stock, buybacks, cryptocurrencies, unicorn. I mean, the individual topics that you dive deeper into. This is fabulous. I'm telling you, if you don't have your copy yet.
Yeah. And thank you, James. You know, and there's that whole thing, and I'm not going to mention names, but one of the biggest cryptocurrency entrepreneurs actually has a house, ocean house, maybe about a mile or two right from here where I live. You know, he has a compound. And, you know, it's just, I think the pool house is 4,500 square feet, just the pool house, you know, but it's a, but they also lost, you know, like hundreds of millions of dollars in a crypto exchange, and no one knows about it. So that's why I'm doing this, James, just because how a country saves and how they invest for retirement is so, so important. Again, America, unfortunately, is an outlier. We're kind of one of the worst in industrialized countries. And actually, you would be better off if you were in the Netherlands or Norway or you know, England or just about anywhere. I mean
we're down there with which I just read this.
Yeah, it's in the
some of these Central American countries.
Oh yeah, it's you know, I was kind of shocked, and this was it's not me. It's on page 2, James, if you see it.
Yeah. It's page 2 and 3. Yep.
Yeah. you know, the Netherlands is, you know, number one, and, you know, in Iceland, Denmark, Israel, Australia, Finland, Singapore, Norway, Sweden, the UK, Switzerland, Canada, Ireland, Chile, Uruguay, Belgium.
Uruguay and Chile is ahead of us. I mean, God bless them. Yeah. I can't wait to go visit those countries, you know. I mean,
yeah, Hong Kong's better than Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan. So, oh my gosh.
And integrity, you know, we're actually one of the worst, which is really kind of, to me, when retirement money, and again, I'm not against market investing, people, you know, but I'm just saying purpose of retirement income plan is reduce retirement income. The purpose of a stock market is to allocate capital, period. It was never built to build retirement income.
All right. Yep. I mean, I don't want to pick on Chile or whatever that third world country was. I mean, we're ahead of them in one component or two, but overall they're ahead of us. What country was that? Colombia. It's like, oh my gosh, we should be ashamed.
We're ahead of France, but I like living in France. I mean, the whole countryside's down. Have you ever been to France? I've been there in France, and the summer, the whole countryside's just down, essentially.
Yeah, I love France. If I ever come up missing, I'm either going to be in France, you know, my people up there in Edinburgh, Scotland, or Austria, or between the three. So, yes, I love France, so, you know.
So the whole
out
thing
in the country.
Okay. So the whole thing is that it's the reason why I'm shouting about this, because I've been in this business long enough, as you know, James, in financial services, there's a real time lag between if a market corrected today, which it could, okay, but it's going to be the time lag, maybe 12, 24 months before the real pain is really felt. And the problem is that the problems which I'm talking about now are eventually going to be huge.
Yeah.
Not now, but 3-4 years from now, 5 years from now, it's going to be horrible. So that's why I'm trying to get people better prepared today.
I agree. There's no time like today. And if you don't care, who will care? I mean, who will care if you don't
care? Yeah, you know, and I make the great example. The government is totally incompetent. Do you remember this guy, Alan Stanford? Actually, do you remember Alan Stanford Financial?
No, I can't say that I do. No.
Well, he was one of the, he was kind of like a crypto queen of the 2000. He sold these certificates of deposits, James, out of Barbados. And he sold, like, you know, billions of them. And as a matter of fact, all these banks sold them for him. And they finally put him in jail in 2009. All right.
No, I mean, just think of that. Wait, I want to buy a certificate of deposit from a bank in Barbados.
Barbados, yep.
I bet it had nothing to do with the rate of return, did it, Barry?
No, but he was making up this stuff and selling them. And, you know, and the major banks, I get into it, were TD Bank, the biggest, largest, one of the large lenders in Canada. You know, HSBC, a lot of these huge entities. I mean, huge.
Hong Kong, Shanghai.
And there was roughly about 7-8 billion lost. Okay. You know when it was settled, James? They finally settled the case?
No.
It was last February. And the final settlement was like $2.7 billion. Okay, so it was so we're talking 14 years. Now they put the guy in jail in 2009. They finally TD Bank and the and I have all the banks in there. And matter of fact, I think I can tell you
is that in this book, this current book?
Yeah, it's in this book here. But matter of fact. Yeah, okay, yeah, I do have it right. It's a conclusion. I've seen $8 billion in losses, okay? And the banks involved in this were TD Bank, HSBC, Hong Kong, Shanghai, Bancorp, Societe Generale, the big French bank, Trustmark National out of, and then there was an independent bank actually out of Houston. And they finally ended up paying $1.2 billion. TD Bank had a $1.2 billion fine, and other banks paid maybe about $300-400 million. My point is that there were $8 billion in losses. There was $2.7 billion in final settlement. But you know how much of that went into? About a third of that went to the lawyers.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So my point is that if you don't take... my point is, why not simplify and stay safe to begin with, okay? Because even when these things do collapse, and there's going to be more of them, okay, it's going to take a long, long time. Because the lawyer's going to tie this shit up forever, okay? So this is what happened. So this is 14 years. So if you're a retiree and with one of these R. Allen Stanford CDs, it took 13, 14 years to recover the money. And it only got 2.7 billion. And a third of that went to the lawyers.
Pennies. Do you remember what the CDs, their face amount or their promised rate was by chance?
I think, you know, again, it's the same thing, Jim. They're always offering a couple like Judas-like returns. When everyone's paying, you know, 5 or 6, they were paying like 7 or 8. You know, it's the same thing that happened in executive life.
Yeah. And it's the boring, you know, the idea that annuities are bad, quote unquote, the insurance company, because look, I've done it 33 years. The insurance companies tie up your money. The agent makes a ridiculous commission. Life insurance is the world's worst place to put money. The same things, you know, they can't have access to your money and blah, blah, blah. And so there's a whole argument that's raging and it's stoked continually. Those things are bad. And look at the rate of return that you can get over here, right, in the market or wherever. And so it's a story to me of the tortoise and the hare. You know, the slow, steady, consistent, reasonable, moderate, respectable rate of return, right? And you can't cherry pick time periods, right? You cannot cherry pick time periods in the financial world, right? And if we look at over your lifetime, you know, a life insurance policy on your life is going to last you your whole life. Okay, that's a long time period. Oh, wait, and then we can talk about 50 years, too, if we're using life insurance and guaranteed annuities that they're structured appropriately, will leave a legacy to the people that you love or the things that you care about. Then you can look at longer time periods beyond your life, right? Slow, the exponential curve of compounding, and that is so diminished in the financial world today. While all of these guys and their individuals on Wall Street and these big corporations, that's where they're putting their money. And guaranteed payouts, but then we're going to restrict the 401k, the retirement plan, whatever it is for the employees to the market. It's like, oh my gosh, the narratives that I continually see, and I know you've seen them, and you know you're more of a gentleman than I am, right? Sometimes I go off and maybe a little too passionate, a little too explicit to me. And I'm not adverse to risk, right? I don't think that, and I'm not a doomsday guy. I'm telling you, I'm an eternal optimist. But to me, in my experience, you know, steady, reasonable, consistent, guarantees compared to maybe, I'm the FOMO, I'm fear of missing out, I'm starting too late, so I got to capture a higher rate of return, you know, and then it's almost you, the individual, you fly by all of these red flags, but you do it anyway, you know, and that's what I see in the narrative of the big wide world. To me, I can imagine losing people's money, much less billions or trillions that they're talking about, and then enjoy, you know, your 5 homes around the world or whatever it is. Oh my gosh, there's this lifetime and one more, and we're all gonna earn what we deserve, you know. To me, and of course, like you, Barry, much like you, you know, we actually provide service to clients. You know, we're actually here as they go through retirement, and they're dependent upon that retirement income and all the expenses of, you know, the rising cost of healthcare and all these things. You can't solve a known problem with an unknown solution. And I can't do it successfully, right? Never have. You know, can we all get lucky? Yes, we can. But if there's a guaranteed in the future, like you're going to have a certain amount of income, right? You want to leave a certain amount to your people or whatever. Those are guaranteed expectations. Those are guaranteed. And you're going to take and make the solution like, well, maybe it'll work. And, you know, we can use the Monte Carlo and we can use all kinds of third-party software and spreadsheets and, you know, cherry-pick the time number or the time period and raise the probabilities of being successful. It that stuff will wear you out. And so a young individual that coming into the financial world, you know, all of that is so mesmerizing to the individual that really wants to do the right thing for their clients, right? This is bad, this is good, and then here's how you prove it or convey it with all of these esoteric calculation spreadsheets and presentations and pro formas. And it's like, that'll wear you out. Maybe I'm just so old, I've become jaded, and I'm tired of being worn out with all that stuff, which happened early on in my career. I'll wrap it up, my comments here, by saying that the working with the right individual, whomever they may be, right, with the right products, whatever they may be. But if you're going to use, you know, or you're going to solve for guaranteed income, or you're going to solve for guaranteed estate value in the future, there should be some consideration, in my humble opinion, given, despite the noise, should be given to an intelligently thought through decision-making process using guaranteed products that are not issued by companies that are stock companies that are targets for all the corporate raiders and, you know, having to meet all of the requirements of Wall Street. No, I'm talking about a mutual structure. And I know that you like to use also a lot of, or you, I don't know whether you use them or not, but fraternal organizations. The whole idea and concept of mutuality, I mean, those ideas and concepts to me are worth investigating for the consumer. So,
there's no question about it, James. And the fact of the matter, which is, the research I did, is that this will come in the next book, is that this is what the rest of the world's doing. I mean, America is, you know, again, we're crazy. I mean, our retirement systems are, our savings systems are upside down. I mean, in terms of savings, James, I can't remember some of the statistics, but I think in savings are like 27 in the top 30. I mean, we're horrible. I mean, and then like press transparency, which is another thing, because we're not getting the truth from the mainstream media. And press transparency, I think we're like number 47 by Reuters or something. Like that. It's like so people are not hearing it through the media, and people are not saved. The problem is, of course, Americans don't save. Because they want to push credit cards on people, and then when we do save, whatever, if we are actually fortunate enough to save, then if we do save in our 401k, and I believe me, I was with a young couple a friend of mine's daughter and new son-in-law, and very successful, but they're maximizing the 401k, they're putting 40, 50 grand into this thing, and they have no idea, you know. And the money's all locked up in a straitjacket for the next 25 years, you know? Yeah. So it's just people just don't know. So these kids are good savers.
Yeah.
But they had no idea that their money was going to feeding the Wall Street casino.
Right. And then being locked up and putting big barriers between you and your capital. And then, you know, just saving it for a future unknown tax rate. You know, an unknown tax bracket. It's and then you know, and I have this conversation all the time. You know, you separate yourself from your capital, then you're beholden to the third party lender, the credit cards, the mortgage company, whatever, whomever, all of them. I mean, What a coincidence. I mean, who is that really built for? Right? Not built for you. It's built for Wall Street and the bankers, period. Period, period. Now, that's not saying that you can't win in Wall Street from time to time. Of course you can win in Wall Street from time to time. You can win in Las Vegas, too. Right? From time to time, you can win in Las Vegas. You do very well. And then it's like, oh, my gosh, then you're always chasing that win. And I know you know, but I like to ask. I was just asked a nice lady yesterday. I said, you know, the question was, do you know what the difference between Wall Street and Las Vegas is, Barry?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, one of them is
a casino in the desert, and the other one's a casino in the island of Manhattan.
I mean, it's like, oh my gosh, can you win? Yeah, you can win. But neither one of those places were built on losses. Their losses.
No, and the whole thing is like one of the biggest casino companies of all time, Caesars Entertainment.
Yep.
Was a giant, which we'll get into Pirates 3, which is one of the largest leveraged buyouts of all history, and $32 billion in 2008, done by Apollo Global Management. And Texas Pacific Group went bankrupt in 2015.
Because of that? Were they part of the deal?
It went into bankruptcy. And it's just, I have the whole story. It's just another show, if you will. But Apollo Global are the people behind Athene.
And the other stock companies that they're buying. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's just,
The guy at Apollo, I mean, wasn't he a protege to one of the other,
Well, that's why you're getting into the Pirates 3, but yeah, actually, this is the irony of the whole thing. All the people who, like, from Athene, they all started with Michael Milken at Drexel.
Okay, there you go.
Leon Black was Michael Milken's right-hand man. Mark Rowan was worked with Drexel too. Josh Harris also worked with him as well. Tony Ressler actually worked with Michael Milken as well. Ressler is so incestuous. Ressler's sister actually married Leon Black. Could make this stuff up. And then they all left and they formed Apollo Global Management. And then in 2009 they formed Athene. But actually, it was actually Goldman, believe it or not, who actually were kind of the guys who started this first, and that's another story to itself. So we'll have another few more stories to talk about, James. But yeah, so it's been taking me a long time, and the hard thing has really been to simplify it so people understand it. But so this is what see, Wall Street is not dumb. They figured out that probably one of the only places, the safe place to put money within an economy is with a life company. So now they're just taking a good thing and they've polluted it, you know? Yeah. But there's still always hope for people if they talk to people like you.
Yeah, and like you, and I appreciate that. All right, so we'll have more to talk about. You know, I think I could talk to you all day long, Barry, and enjoy our conversations. I am excited about your book, The Retirement Ruse. If you don't have a copy, you should get a copy. Yes, I haven't read it. Full disclosure, I've only read 16 pages. But now I got to go back and highlight. There's so much to highlight in 16 pages. That's crazy.
Thank you so much, James.
You're welcome. We're going to make this available in our store, and surely they can go to your website and buy it, right?
Yeah, go to barryjamesdeck.com. There's only certain you can get off of your website, or I'm just on my website. But I haven't even put it on Amazon. It's been kind of a soft launching this one because because
you're busy writing your third Pirates of Manhattan.
Yeah, right? It's just one of those things. You know, I just wanted to do, and it's a goal of mine. And you know what? I've been researching this for 15, 16 years. So it's just something I really wanted to share with people because. It's not just about us, but it's about our kids and their kids and leaving the place a little bit better than the way we found it.
Yeah, I agree. And I know I'm not as old as I look, but I can't remember the first time we met, but I believe it was in Alabama and you were doing that's where I met you, and Nelson was there. I'd met him previously. You had known him previously, and it might've been an early think tank. You know, I don't remember, but I think it was an early.
I hate to say it, James. 2007. When I do Pirates, first Pirates book, 2007. Yeah.
This is when you were doing the research.
Oh, so this is in 2004. The first Pirates book, yeah.
All right, so when you say you've been researching this a long time, and that's when I met you, Barry, and that's whenever you were doing, at that time, you were doing the research for Pirates of Manhattan 1. I mean, my point here is you've been doing research a long time. There's 20 years that I know of.
So I actually started researching the first Pirates book in 2004. And, then the financial crisis came out, and then, the book still sells incredibly well today. Believe it or not, it should.
16, it's 17 completely years old. Relevant.
And yeah, one of the top financial advisors in all of Canada, a guy named Bruce Etherington, just a wonderful man. I mean, he just works with multi-billionaires and stuff like that. He just bought like 100 copies. He gives to all his clients. And this is 16, 17 years ago. But I started the research for Pirates Manhattan 3 around 2008 because I started talking about leveraged buyouts and private equity and venture capital. I said, what is this stuff? How did they miss it? It's like $8 trillion of part of the economy. So it just has to be addressed.
Yeah, that's crazy. Okay, so let's just wrap it up right here, if you don't mind, Barry. And it did kind of go a little long enough that we'll make two parts out of it. Okay. So thank you again, as always, sir, for coming on.
Yeah, I'll see you soon.
Yep, just in a couple of months.
Yeah, and I'll have Lisa, whatever, make some plans. I've just been so we're good. So I hope we get something out of this.
We will. It'll be what it is, you know. Not over. I mean, nothing is ever scripted on my podcast. And I'm the firm believer, if an individual knows what they're talking about, you know, they know the subject, I don't have to say anything or coach anything, you know, just let them talk. Right. So people love you. They love your work. And, you know, and I'm pleased and blessed that you, share your time with us and our listeners, whomever they may be. You know, it'll benefit you if you would listen, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thank you for your, because I want to kind of on this stuff now, James, I want to kind of really bring it to the next level. Once you can get on guys like Rogan, or whatever, at some point, because I think it's really, it's going to even boost you even more.
Perfect. I need all the help I can get, Barry. All right. So I'm going to wind it up here. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.